Ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, in the first few minutes of the conversation you are about to hear, one of the microphones decided to blow out. And while our correspondent was equipped with two microphones, the microphone that decided to blow out on us wasn't the one that was on our correspondent's voice, but the one that was pinpointed on the author, Annalena McAfee. So, Miss McAfee's words can be detected, but if her voice sounds like it's coming out of a small radiator, well, you now know why.
I've nothing left. I'm all but dead.
Okay, so I am here with Annalena McAfee, who was most recently the author of The Spoiler. Annalena, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Fantastic. Now, let's go ahead and start with a general question. The journalism-based novel has a long tradition. The obvious one, of course, is Evelyn Waugh's Scoop, New Grub Street. There's even Woodhouse's Smith Journalist, which is a favorite one of mine. But
I love that. Crazy moment.
Yes, exactly. I know, and I love Woodhouse. But I'm curious what creative steps you took to distinguish this novel from the pre-existing journalist novels. I mean, how much did you steep yourself in this great literary history, and is there a certain risk in exposing yourself to too many of these tropes for what, you know, some might argue is possibly a limited type of genre, or what happened here? Let's just get started.
Well, I think every newspaper journalist, I worked as a journalist for many years, loves this stuff. We're all narcissists, and we love to read about ourselves. And yeah, indeed, the tradition goes way back. Mm-hmm. Maupassant has addressed it. For myself, on the shoulders of giants, certainly.
Yeah.
But one thing that I felt left me freer to start my newspaper novel was the big change in demographic that has not been picked up in the genre so far, which is the number of women working in journalism now.
True.
All the journalists. Novels of journalism, even, you know, the comparatively recent great novel of Michael Frayn's
Towards
the End of Morning,
yes,
was reflecting a world in which women were in the minority in the newsroom. If they were there, they were secretaries or decorative figures. Or
you could argue that this might actually be a flaw of Rockman's The Imperfectionist, which we were talking about before we started rolling, how it's a very male-centric novel, if you think about it, you know?
It's a male-centric novel in terms of the professionals,
yes.
But I think one of the most challenging and intriguing characters is the woman.
Sure.
Who is really wrecked by the end of newspapers.
Sure. So really it was just exposing yourself to the long legacy of women that really sort of allowed you to find a hook in. Why do you think that journalism novels really weren't actually working that angle? Is it just because there's just so many guys who are pumping out these journalism novels, or what?
No, I think I am pretty up to speed with the genre.
Of course.
But when Waugh was writing, there were no women on the news desk. There were no women Waugh correspondents. And even when Michael Frayn was writing in 1967, you know, a woman would be a rare thing on a news desk. So, you know, I looked at some of the surveys, census in America at the turn of the century, something like 2% of working journalists were women, and all of them were writing about soft furnishings, and there were the notable exceptions of Nellie Bly, the Sob Sisters, and the stunt women, who were there as a kind of gimmick.
Yeah.
But
and don't forget the Hedda Hoppers and the Luella Parsons.
Yes.
Parsonses. I'm curious, does much of this book account for your novel style? You contain phrases such as nasal plain chant and greedy nieces squabbling like magpies over glittering scraps. Is style enough for you to transcend tropes, to delve into an unexposed area of journalism? How does language offer discovery of certain human truths that research or plunging yourself into this history of women journalists has not?
Gosh, well, I think whatever the subject, one should aim to write well, and style is key. I would hope that the subject has a wider reach than, it's not just for former members of the National Union of Journalists.
Yeah.
and it the newsroom does seem to have an iconic appeal. I mean, I was looking at the Gallagher stories at the end of Gallagher Newsboy at the end of the 19th century, very end, I think 1897, and you know, plucky little newsboy who becomes a hack, you know, gets the scoop against all the odds. And that was a huge hit in the States. And apparently, in the 50s, there was a TV series, Gallagher the Newsboy, which was a sort of...
I'm only vaguely familiar with that. So you're more up to speed on our journalistic narratives than I am, that's for sure.
Well, I just think as well, you know, it, the setting is one thing, but it's what you do with it.
And, sure.
And, you know, not to put myself in the same illustrious category, but, you know, you don't have to be an expert in 19th century farming practices to read Anna Karenina, for instance, you know, but you can be drawn in.
Do you think that going back to these early 20th century narratives accounts for why the style is a little formal at times and very writing those that very sort of anglicized language, which I liked, by the way, but I'm just curious about that sort of formality that's there.
Well, there's formality, and I hope also there's a rather more slangy voice that comes through,
yeah,
because I'm telling the story with two characters, very different perspectives,
sure,
very different cultural backgrounds, very different eras. So the veteran journalist who's very patrician background, very privileged, she does talk in a very arcane BBC pre-war announcer kind of way. Whereas the young woman who is not so well educated and steeped in pop culture, I hope I've given some voice to her with a slightly more relaxed and contemporary feel. That was the aim anyway.
Sure. Well, let's talk about the character balance. I mean, to some degree, this book does, in fact, stack the deck against Tamara Sim, this journalist who botches this interview in rather horrifying terms. I'm a guy who does a lot of interviews, and I'm like, boy, I'm glad I never did an interview that terrible. But she's trying to write this 4,000-word profile of Honor Tate, the legendary journalist who you're talking about. But the sheer level of entitlement that Tamara has, along with her failure to recognize such basic facts as, oh, say, the burning of the Great Library of Alexandria, I mean, you know, this leads the reader who believes in journalistic tenets to basically say, oh, God, this woman just needs to be stopped. So I'm wondering, you know, you've given her this drug-addicted brother, Ross, and I'm wondering, as a recovering journalist, how difficult was it for you to sort of find any redeeming value in this particular person who really, I mean, just as someone who really believes very highly in doing the prep work and actually doing the preliminary stuff, I was not inclined to really like her, although I was fascinated by her. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, she's a kind of monster, but also I hope has some redeeming qualities in her personal life at that level anyway. She's trying to do the best she can.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's also working with in a culture in which, you know, vulgar tittle-tattle is king, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the other hand, the older, the veteran woman journalist, the war correspondent, isn't exactly a paragon.
Sure.
So I was trying to introduce an element of complexity here and say that, as in life, you know, we're all half devils and half angels.
Sure. Well, you think that Tamara was more of a victim of the journalistic sausage factory? Is that sort of how you can defend some of her actions of wanting to plunge into an area which she not only doesn't know anything about it, but doesn't even want to really know anything about it? She's insisting in Honor's affairs, the whole thing with, oh yes, you were with Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, blah, blah, blah. You know? Look, I'm biased because I like to, I mean, but I'm wondering, you know.
I'm biased too.
Well, how do you as an author counter your own bias? I mean, that's
the great
challenge.
By trying to inhabit this character and see how it would work. I mean, she's also, unlike the older woman, she's not from a privileged background.
Yeah.
she has to work to pay her mortgage, or pay her rent, and she is providing what the newspapers want. This, you know, as the newspapers were scrambling to halt circulation decline, just on the brink of the internet when everything fell off a cliff.
Yes.
There was this plunge down market, and she's aiming to deliver that stuff.
Yeah.
She wouldn't be my friend.
Yeah.
She doesn't have any curiosity.
But getting inside her head at that meeting where she's just like, yes, they're going to go ahead and all eyes will be on me. I mean, you know, that is quite narcissistic, I must say, this temperament to inhabit. That's taking a big gamble, a gamble I like, with the reader who, if you want the reader to sympathize with this character. Or is this just simply, unfortunately, the realities of journalism during this particular time, roughly around 97 or so?
I think narcissism pre and post dated 1997 in journalism as in much else. I don't know where I'm going with this one. It was a cusp moment in journalism.
Yeah.
And no one knew what was going to happen. They felt the sort of chill winds, but they didn't realize that the gale was going to be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the culture that I attempted to describe, this crazy tabloid celebrity culture, which is completely immoral, not just amoral, but immoral.
Sure.
We now know, when technology advanced, just where it led.
Mm-hmm.
Our Leveson inquiry into journalistic ethics is uncovering stuff that is horrifying to, you know, people who've worked in journalism for years are amazed by it. But it was the desperate scramble to be first with a story, any story, and, you know, TV stars, and that was the preoccupation.
Sure.
She's not awfully bright. Let's say that as well.
I think that's an understatement. I mean, you know, look, I do feel sorry for her. I mean, there are a lot of people who even inhabit journalism today who have this problem where they got in at a certain time and they can't get out, and they're sort of stuck being there, and they're stuck trying to find some way to adapt for this. You see this very much actually in America in sports journalism. But actually, while we're talking about journalism, the one thing I was curious about asking you about is, and I'm going to try to do this without giving it away, but the ultimate revelation near the end involves a cache for a story.
Yes.
And it really relies very much on a single source situation.
Yes.
There's no independent corroboration of the facts checking this particular guy out. And now, American journalism is very anal about fact-checking, more so than British journalism. But I wanted to ask you about this, because this was one issue I may have had with the book, is the fact that, wait a minute, if I were running a newspaper or a magazine, I wouldn't give a boatload of cash to someone when I only have one particular side of the story. I'm going to have either a private investigator or, you know, I'll check this person out. So I'm wondering why that was.
Well, that would have been... I'm quite sure there were several kiss and tell stories, disreputable people claiming to have slept with, you know, children's TV presenters or something like that, who were given the money and then proved to be not reliable.
Fleet Street was more profligate in the 1990s.
Yes,
it was
crazy. It was like Rome before the fall.
Sure. The fall of Rome is actually, that's what Honor says at that awards ceremony.
Yeah.
Well, so I mean, like, what types of super scandals comparable to the one that you depict in your book happened on Fleet Street? I'm curious. What would be a comparable thing where someone handed, say, like, £100,000 to someone for a single source story that was sort of...
I do remember... transvestite prostitutes, one in particular claiming to have slept with a a TV presenter with a family profile. But you know, the atmosphere in the newsroom of these papers was so profligate and sort of crazily merry and puffed up with a sense of power. And in fact, at the time that I set my novel, which January 1997, the big story, it didn't have a direct parallel with mine, but it was that a Tory MP, who was a family man, mm-hmm. had slept with a young man, and it was supposed to be, you know, illegal sex.
Yes.
That is what they said. So the young man at the time, this was several years ago, had been 18, and this was before the age of consent was lowered.
Yes.
For homosexual relations. So at the time of writing, it was not illegal, but this was a huge story. It was a huge, you know, they doorstepped the man, his family, and some people even thought that it might have contributed to the downfall of the Conservative government.
Sure.
So, you know, that level of prurience and delight in the trashing of someone's lives, it was going on all the time.
When you worked as a journalist, did you, number one, ever succumb to this feeling of wanting to tear somebody down? And number two, did you experience any interview along the lines of what is in this book? I mean, did you ever have any blundering conversation with some notable figure in which you just totally fell on your ass like that? I'm just curious.
I had some grumpy, one in particular, very grumpy theatre person who was
grumpy people tend to go into the theatre field, I find. And either that or they become writers.
Yeah, but mostly people were very kind and very tolerant.
Sure.
And I did do my best to do my research and took it very seriously, but in terms of tearing people down, I did not work in that world really.
Yeah.
So very I worked on the Financial Times, which
yes.
Is a fantastic paper, and probity is unimpeachable. I worked on The Guardian, and The Culture. I founded and edited The Guardian Review. And again, that's a paper that's on the side of Angels, so I'm very,
sure.
very lucky. I had a spell on The Evening Standard, but I was arts editor and theatre critic, and I suppose in my capacity as theatre critic, sometimes I might have been less than kind, but it certainly wasn't the kind of sustained bullying, or I didn't have that opportunity, and I hope that if I did, I would be able to resist it.
So you were really perhaps comparable to the Monitor's books editor the morning after the party, where everybody else was completely trashed and their heads were throbbing and they were incapable of any conversation. And meanwhile, those who chose not to imbibe in this debauchery decided to actually go ahead, and they were able to seize control, to seize the reins here, so to speak.
Books editors can do debauchery too.
Of course.
But,
books people can do, yes.
Yes.
We all know this.
But there was no character assassinations or kiss and tells on my particular feat, thankfully.
Sure. I wanted to go back to the question of character balance, because you have this confident young woman named Tanya. She's dutifully reading books. She's researching her subjects.
She's called Tamara, but the old woman gets her name wrong and calls her Tanya sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm talking, yeah, exactly. Anyway, she even is very nice to respond to the quip.
Tanya Sim.
No, that's who I'm saying, Tanya.
You know my book better than I do.
I know that Honor, in a joke, actually calls her Tanya, and that's the clue that there is actually something askew, because she completely insists on Tanya. You have that email joke of the, But okay, so now that we're on the same page. So anyway, so you've got Tanya.
Yeah.
She's this erudite person who's incredibly capable. And she's even kind enough to offer this tinsely chime that you describe when Tamara says, oh, well, the future is unisex jumpsuits and time travel. But this does not exactly help us in warming to tomorrow because, you know, I was reading this book and I'm saying to myself, you know, Tanya, this woman's got her stuff together. But I'm wondering how you worked out your method of parceling out Tanya's appearances throughout the book, because they tended to be somewhat sparse near the beginning. And I almost got the sense that as you were working on this, that you wanted to not have so much of Tanya, because then all of a sudden we'll really not like Tamara. You know, I'm wondering how you balanced the T's here.
Well, I did kind of see Tanya as the future.
Yes.
Omni-capable, young woman journalist, brilliant, and completely ahead of the game as far as technology.
Yeah.
And of course, as I say that, that was a time, 1997, it was still possible to believe that the internet was a passing fad.
Yes.
And indeed, some of our great commentators said so. Mm-hmm. It'll be over soon. It's like citizen band radio. It's like Esperanto. It's a craze. It'll pass. I use a quote from one of our great commentators saying exactly that in January 1997. So that's what Tamara and all her colleagues are thinking. But gradually, I hope that as a young woman who runs the website, as the future makes itself plain, as we see what direction it's going in, that was the aim, that, you know, ultimately the future belongs to Tanya, and she claims it.
But did you worry that she might have, in fact, been too virtuous? I mean, you've got two characters who have issues with Tamara and Honor, and you've got Tanya, who has not a single bad bone, as far as I know, in her body. So, I mean, how do you deal with this balance? Because if you have too much of Tanya, then it gets away from the two center characters, the two central characters here. And so I'm wondering how, if there was more of Tanya in an earlier draft, perhaps, or you had to sort of say to yourself, well, I have to wait 20, 30 pages before she appears again.
Well, no, there wasn't more of Tanya. And actually, trying for complexity. And to be perfectly honest, I find Tanya's virtuousness and her capability slightly irritating.
Oh.
You know, she's the person who does one's own job better than one could ever do, and, you know, is always last to leave the office, and she doesn't laugh much. Her tinsley chimes are part of a game rather than a sense of humor.
No, it's more of a polite gesture, I thought. I mean, here she has been just totally insulted, and instead of actually allowing herself to be steamrolled, she decides to respond with some grace, the tinsely
grace,
China.
Yeah, or the terror of the victor.
Yeah. I mean, you know, here's the other thing about Tanya. I mean, you know, I know people like this. They go ahead and they work very hard, but they have a dark side. So I was reading this book thinking, you know, Tanya's probably doing something we don't know, but yet we actually never actually get it. So I'm wondering, you know, why?
That's probably true. That is probably true. And in fact, she does move in on people.
That's
She's
true.
She's incredibly attractive.
Yeah.
That's another of her irritating virtues, but she uses it and is jockeying for position and is not afraid to use her sexuality.
Yeah. Nevertheless, you find her irritating.
Well,
the successful woman here is irritating. Wait a minute here.
No, but she doesn't have warmth, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's really it. She, you know, she's hard to read, and she doesn't seem generous to her colleagues. That's what she,
I see. Yeah, okay.
She lacks generosity.
Yeah. She sort of moves in on the territory, and she does so without really seeing what the pecking order is.
And I say she's got the ambition of a young Napoleon.
And that's an annoying quality.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. So it's interesting that you have the Monday Club in this book, because it's far more liberal than the conservative Monday Club, because you have this, the Twisk Foundation fighting child exploitation wherever it is to be found. You have the war correspondent. And I'm saying to myself, you know, this is almost sort of like a bizarro world Monday Club. And so I'm wondering why you decided to go for a more, I suppose, progressive form of something that is a conservative institution in the UK.
They meet on a Monday, but I chose that.
You could have been the Tuesday Club.
Yeah. But I quite liked, I mean, I think I do say an ironic reference to the conservative right-wing think tank of the same name or whatever. So I quite like playing with that. I mean, these are, you know, bien pensant liberals, and they've taken the name of, you know, the sort of arch factory of Thatcherism.
Yeah. Do you have any personal experience with the real Monday Club at all, or
no?
Or any efforts to sort of peek in there?
No, not at all. I can't think.
So Sherman Duffy, he was a reporter friend of Ben Hecht's, and he has this very famous maxim. He said, "Socially, a journalist fits somewhere between a whore and a bartender." Wonderful, wonderful line. Now, in the Monday Club chapter, you not only have Tamara serving canapés to these affluent types, but you also have Ruth, Honors publisher. She's actually engaged in this service sector activity as well. She's unpacking the pastries on the plate and so forth. So I'm wondering if you were thinking of the Duffy maxim when you were considering this. This is a natural extension. Is there any way that fiction can help us and assist us in rehabilitating a journalist's social status from the, you know, somewhere between the whore and a bartender?
Well, I mean, journalists are happy to see themselves as mavericks, aren't they? Certainly British journalists.
Yeah.
I know that American journalism is a more honorable tradition.
Really?
I was talking with a friend about this the other night, and she said that there's more of a public service attitude, and it can make for more solemn journalism.
Yeah.
In the UK, it's, well, you know, anything can go.
Yeah. So you would say that journalism in the UK has declined considerably in the last 10 years?
Oh, no. Or
20 years here.
I wouldn't. I mean, I think there's marvelous stuff going on. Absolutely marvelous. And the fact all that's changed is the medium, really.
Yeah.
You know, that when you think, I mean, in terms of, my war correspondent is not, she's a bit of a dragon, and she resents the fact that the world has turned and she is not top of the pile anymore. In fact, if she'd looked around, she would have much to celebrate, particularly women in journalism. Women like Marie Colvin, the late Marie Colvin in Russia, Anna Politkovskaya, who actually died in the course of her work. There's marvelous reporting going on, but there's also a lot of dross.
Yeah.
That's all mainstream. I don't get celebrity journalism. I just can't understand the appeal.
But some would argue that cultural journalism is, I suppose, a classier version of celebrity journalism. What do you think?
Yeah.
I ask myself this question too. I mean, I've read the book and I'm trying to tie it into a larger culture here, and I don't want it to be about gossip. But, you know, at the same time, well, is this conversation also part of the problem, even if it's, I guess, slightly higher on the brow?
Well, that's what somebody said, that novels were higher gossip.
Yes.
That's the level of celebrity journalism that appeals to me. TV stars, reality TV shows. I mean, I don't want to go into that, but that seems to be cheap television and cheap journalism.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's anything edifying that one gets from it.
Well, the problem we have here, too, is, and this is really frustrating, it's like David Simon, for example, recently said some things in an interview where he was just trying, and he didn't quite really express himself very well, but he basically implied that people who didn't watch The Wire from beginning to middle to end were not watching it according to his vision. And I could totally understand his sentiment, but from my standpoint, I was saying, you know, this is really nothing to get all that worked up about. But of course, television journalists
completely flipped out over this and said David Simon is being an ass. And then Simon then has to spend an hour of his life talking to this TV critic named Seppenwall, who and basically clarifying what he was coming from. And this, to my mind, is the epitome of this says nothing about The Wire. This says absolutely nothing about the actual relationship to art. And there were several people, including like a New Yorker TV critic on Twitter, who were going off about this. And I was saying to myself, you know, why are you devoting so much of your energy to try to systematically dismantle and deconstruct a quote that really has no bearing on what David Simon is doing as an artist? I mean, do you think, I mean, the suggestion I'm having here, and I'm going off on a total tangent and we will get back to your book, is that, you know, do you think that cultural journalism might be suffering from the same problems that this reality TV, this sensationalistic journalism is?
Oh yes, I do. I find that a lot of interviews, and I know we're having an interview.
Yeah, I know. It's very meta here.
But they, you know, concentrate on rehashing old stuff. Rehashing the cuttings, basically. Inquiring, as Tamara does, about affairs, about the personal life, and not about the work. And when I was on The Guardian, we started a profile, which was actually a central interview about a writer or an artist, and the one rule was it was about the work.
Yeah.
You don't care what personal life. Anyway, if anyone cares about the personal life, they can read it, they can look it up, they
sure.
can read it elsewhere. But what's really interesting is the work, and I find that so much more enriching when I...
There is one question I have about your husband and you, and it has nothing to do really with the personal, although it may actually have something to do with the personal, but we're talking about purely artistic terms. Okay, one, you've got an in-house editor. I'm really curious about how you two work as in-house editors. And two, I noticed that this book had quite a bit in common with Amsterdam. You have a photo that is released, you have... editors who are sacked. And so I wondered, first of all, if Amsterdam was kind of hovering over you as you were writing this. And second, you know, how do you guys edit each other's work? That's all I care about. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Well.
Or do you? Or do you leave
yes,
each other alone?
We do read. I read his work. I'm his first reader with a pencil.
Sure.
And he returned the compliment. In terms of Amsterdam, which I love. It's a great newspaper novel, actually.
Yeah.
Though it's guys, again.
Yeah.
I hadn't reread it for a while, but I guess any newspaper novel about modern journalism is going to have this scandal and element to it. So, in fact, what you asked me is a fairer question, less compromising than the... When I was on the FT and I was editing the arts and books pages, I was invited to the BBC to... and it was around the time of the Booker Prize, when the Booker Prize was going to be announced, shortlist was going to be announced, and I was asked to come on as literary editor of the Financial Times. So I turned up and I'm very nervous on television. Just absolute agony. And I turn up in this bright lit studio, and the guy turns to me and said, "So, did you help hubby write the book?" what do you say?
Yeah.
I said, "No, he's perfectly capable of writing himself, thanks very much." But no, he wrote Amsterdam unassisted, as I wrote.
I would have said, "Did your wife help you with that question?"
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but so you guys edit each other's work. Is there a point where you sort of say, "Hey, hands off, Ian, I've got this"? I mean, you know, does he become too vigorous with the pen, or do you become in turn too vigorous for the pen? How do you keep each other's hands off? Because, you know, what's the deal with you guys?
Well, it's very companionable.
Yeah.
And decent. Yeah. And, you know, we both make suggestions, and we both know that we're at liberty to ignore them, which is what happens. But when I read his first the first book when we were together was Enduring Love.
Yeah.
And I read that, and he asked me, you know, be as free as you like and put pencil marks wherever there's any kind of doubt. And I was very tentative about it. I mean, I was used to editing for a living, but it was very tentative about hurting feelings. And I had, I've written children's books.
So yes, I know. Yeah.
I had a children's book that was just coming out. Mm-hmm. And so he said, oh, I'd like to see that. And he went through it, and there were pencil marks and suggestions. And I thought, right, that's how it's done. So I, no holds barred. I went back to Enduring Love and pulled no punches. And it's been like that ever since.
What is, did you pull no punches on the opening scene? I'm curious.
Oh, that's no, that. I mean, no one can.
No, there's no work required. Really, absolutely. Okay. No, it's superb.
I don't want to just talk about Ian. I wanted to actually talk about Marguerite Higgins. You point out in the acknowledgments that she was the model for Honor Tate. I'm wondering why Higgins captured your interest more than, say, Gloria Emerson or Kate Webb. In fact, actually, while I was looking up women journalists, especially those who covered, you know, wars and all that, I ran into the... You've seen the clip of Gloria Emerson interviewing John Lennon and Yoko Ono?
No, how does that go?
Oh, God, I'll have to send it to you. So basically, they're doing the whole... Give peace. This is the give peace a chance days, right? And they're trying to actually promote peace. And Gloria Emerson, who has actually seen war, is talking with them. And this conversation is not going well at all. And John Lennon insists, I've grown up. I'm not the mop top guy. And Gloria Emerson is basically eventually, and it's captured. It's in the movie Imagine John Lennon. And it captures this moment where Gloria Emerson, well, clearly we're boring each other, and she just walks out. And you know, it's one of I have to ask, you know, I mean, I'm getting off on a tangent, but I'm wondering, you know, why it was Marguerite more than any of these other
Well, her story, I mean, I was at pains to say that she wasn't that my character was not definitely Marguerite.
No, of course not.
But
why she was a huge influence, yes.
Yeah, and well, I very much enjoyed the biography and also Marguerite Higgins' own writing. But she was such an interesting and complex character. I mean, as well as being incredibly courageous in her work, she was very beautiful and was not afraid to use her beauty, in pursuit of a scoop, and ruthlessly competitive. I mean, spectacularly so. She was at Columbia, and they were given an assignment, and this was the journalism students. And this was in the days when all the resources, all the research material would be found in the library.
Yeah.
And the her fellow students went to the library to get out some material. She checked it all out, you know. So she wasn't going to have time to read it, but she did it to ensure that no one else stole a march. So she was like that. And she infuriated and captivated people.
Yeah.
She was at the right place at the right time, but she also, her colleagues, she infuriated and captivated. And she was inspired not one, but two roman à clé novels by colleagues.
Yes.
One male, one female. And they were all about beautiful, ruthless journalists who will do anything to get a story.
What do you think we've lost with the internet, journalistic-wise?
What have we lost? Gosh. Accountability. I mean, I think you still have to go to the sources, the wells. You have to go to the New York Times and the sources that you trust, because there's so much misinformation out there. So it does rely on a kind of filtering on the part of the reader, but I would say stick with the your favorite news gathering organization for reliability. What have we lost? We've lost the spike, actually. So, you know, it can be unlimited now what you write, whereas in print, you know, it would be locked off at the end if it overran.
Yeah.
Now we don't have to worry about space or.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have seen. I mean, I'm basing this largely on American journalism, but those long articles we used to have in the '90s are almost gone. I mean, you have to go to places like, you know, maybe Esquire or Rolling Stone, but ultimately, like, those really investigative pieces, well, they're being revived to some degree with Amazon long reads. But ultimately,
yes, and
I mean, you know,
singles.
Exactly. I mean, and there's still The New Yorker. But by and large, just there used to be all these places where, and it actually helped support, like, novelists between books, right? And
yes.
And I have seen, speaking of cultural reporting, I mean, you know, you used to be able to have like 2,000 word reviews on all the books. Now you're lucky if you get 250 words. So I don't know. I mean, there's also a disadvantage with lopping things off like that. Or what are your thoughts on this?
Well, cultural journalism goes in cycles, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there was the great dumbing down era when, you know,
the maximization, you know, the Maxim like sort of influence where Maxim made everything infograph like in all the magazines and newspapers
yes.
had to copy that.
Exactly. Yeah. And Kylie Minogue was of
yes.
equal value to Keats, and not my taste, but I think the internet allows us to be more focused and to pursue our own, you know, our separate. So if we like Keats, there's a feast for us there, and there
yeah.
are long form essays and academic pieces that we can draw on. In journalism, well, I hold out a lot of hope, really, for the Kindle single,
yeah.
long form. There's a very good aggregate website in the UK called The Browser.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Yeah. And Arts and Letters used to be very, very good as an aggregator. Right?
Yeah, until the guy just recently died. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. So that's fantastic. I mean,
yeah.
go on that, the Browser. And
yeah.
You see what riches there are.
Well, the thing is, the great irony is that something like Twitter has made Arts and Letters Daily sort of obsolete, because if people are on there and you're following them and they have those vital links that they found, you click mm-hmm. on them, like they're basically, everybody's a curator now.
Yes,
you're both
yes.
a curator and a conversationalist in chunks. And so I suppose this is also the future. This might also be lopping things off, because you only have 140 characters to express yourself.
Yeah.
Were there any things that you observed that you decided not to include in this novel?
I don't know. I mean, I think it is fair to point out that the lifestyles of the very censorious tabloid journalists, they're very censorious in print, do not bear examination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're as prone to addictions and misbehaviors and marital catastrophe as everyone else.
Yeah.
And yet they're so censorious about other people. That was all I was trying to say. So they would do a story, and that was a genuine story about a, you know, some poor kid, 16-year-old boy, set up buying marijuana, and
yeah.
he's a son of someone in the public eye. So they make a huge story of that, pillory the father, and the poor boy is no doubt traumatized by it, and yet they're all at it themselves.
Yes. Well, so to bring this conversation full circle, it seems to me that the journalism novel is really driven by obsession. That is the ultimate emotion that is being explored, perhaps, in all of these journalism novels, including yours.
Obsession,
yes. This kind of what we're talking about here. This just this need to get the story, this need to do it even though you might actually fail, you know?
Yeah. It is a very particular impulse, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. But maybe it translates to other areas too.
Sure.
Maybe, other areas of work too. Science must
yeah.
be getting the cure.
Yeah.
novel writing, getting the book that works. I suppose in journalism there are so many pressures to get the story, and as well as, you know, the internal pressure of the journalistic sensibility. You won't survive if you're not first.
Sure.
It's kind of desperate struggle for survival.
Yeah. Well, on that natural selection note. Annalena, it was a pleasure to chat. Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
got his feelings hurt, singing that old standard. You can't break a rule that ain't been made. By starlight chasing ponytails through mushroom clouds and black fields, I don't wanna feel this entertained. Sitting on a crowded coach, staring at the stereo, watching all the hippies through the haze. From gentle soul to Santa stones, no one wants to be alone. But you know you can't always have